And every time that thing comes around, it picks it and makes sure it's in the right place. And says, okay, you got X number of bytes from here. Start counting. So each little one or zero that comes at you counts as another place. Follow?
Martin, I'm hearing lots of requirements for accuracy of amplitude, frequency, and phase of clocks to make things work right. I'm not yet hearing where that local accuracy of clock is coming from. Over to you, Eric.
Okay. The signal that you are receiving that is coming from the transmitter, that timing actually is being generated by the encoder. Okay, and each time it produces this clock word at a particular periodic rate according to specifications of the, or the paradigm of the actual protocol that's being sent. Then in the receiver, there is a data separator that looks for this particular sequence and says, okay, I got a pulse. So you know darn well that you can take a GPS clock and use one PPS to make a very accurate oscillator. Same sort of deal.
Okay, now I'm going to repeat the question, so to speak, a little bit differently. If I've got a local source of GPS accuracy of disciplined oscillator to do those clocking functions that you're now mentioning, and if I now inject that into my Cadillac digital demodulator, and I'm looking at an over-the-air signal that's corrupted by multipath and impulse noise.
Okay, I know how to answer you.
Do I come out ahead in my vulnerability to proper demodulation? Over to you, Eric.
6DTZ is still in here. I'd like to make a couple more comments before I close out.
Oh, we've already had your subject, Hal. Are you going back to it?
Just to say, I was thinking of the concept, this would be a club project, the club would handle it, they would supply the parts and the boards. I'm just going to give the design and the schematics carte blanche to the club. And the club could take it and fly with it, there's enough interest. I figured there'd be enough interest because everybody can get on one frequency as members of the club and go QRPCW. That's my only comment. I'll leave it at that, gentlemen. K6DBZ.
Okay, Hal, you've already said that twice, and the six people who signed in also said it. We got the message. Go ahead, Eric, you wanted to say something.
Okay, I understand what you're asking. Actually, right now, today, this minute, the way things are, to use GPS in terms of making the demodulator work ain't going to happen. Simply because the only thing that GPS controls and the way things are set up currently at the broadcast end is the oscillator and the transmitter that puts it, you know, that is the carrier generator for the transmitter of the PSPC. In order for the demodulation process to work the way you want it to, then have to GPS time or at least phase lock the data that's being sent into the modulator or the exciter, the transmitter, so is that there is a timing reference with the data that's coming out. So there's actually a simple way to do that, and that's just simply to use a remuxer that has its master oscillator phase lock with a GPS system or the oscillator, and then that whole system could work.
Okay, now, let me try and get a beep. To my knowledge, cell sites are doing this. They are all GPS disciplined locked oscillators. If your broadcast center was GPS disciplined oscillator locked, and my demodulator also had, by some other means, access to the same GPS accuracy, so that now I've got correlation between the oscillator at the transmitter, your site, and the oscillators at my site, the receiving site, with my demodulator. If we do those two things, and in 2015, I think that is very doable. If we do those two things, do I come up with an advantage in vulnerability of demodulation in the presence of impulse noise? noise and multipath. KE2EJ, K2RAW.
Okay, if you do what I just described in terms of the transport stream being GPS locked, whereas the transmitter's frequency reference is GPS locked, because currently now, like Channel 21, its reference oscillator is GPS locked. But the transport stream information inside is not. Okay, WNET is not GPS locked, it's running on its own internal oscillator. So, in the case of Channel 21, if you put a GPS GPS device oscillator on your receiver and ran the clocks with it, you probably will get a lot of scrambled nothing because it won't be synchronous with what's being transmitted. If I put a remultiplexer at this end and had that connected to a GPS-trained oscillator, then it would work perfectly, and you would just see speckles and stuff, and you would never have your receiver disappear on you. So RWK2J.
Eric, what you've just described sounds to me very doable. Has somebody written a proposal saying these are the advantages of doing that? And if somebody has written that proposal, is it being properly propagated, promulgated, advocated? If not, why not? Over to you, Eric, K2RAW.
Yeah, I don't know if anybody's actually thought about it. I could email Stagnoli and ask him about that. But from everything that I'm seeing and hearing, the people that I know that are involved in it, nobody's thinking about AGST 2.0 anymore. They're moving on. Now, that's something that should be put to them in terms of, if you have the ability to have a GPS locked receiver, why not?
Okay, they haven't thought about it, but that doesn't mean they shouldn't be thinking about it. And when they go to ATSC 3.0, which has all these potential advantages, but you and I know that every time you go into something new, there's going to be growing pains, there's going to be pitfalls, there's going to be a minefield out there, there's going to be a number of disadvantages that we slowly discover and have to work around. And so as you go to higher bit rates, where these oscillator synchronizations become even more vulnerable, if you didn't think about this early enough, I think it's going to come back and bite us. I think that memo that you're describing to Spagnoli, I think it's overdue, Eric, and you go ahead and claim all of the credit for it. That doesn't bother me, because most of it come from you. It came from you anyhow, but you got to talk Spagnoli into pursuing this, and if you ask him the question the right way, maybe the question is going to be, if you don't think we should be doing it, why do you think we shouldn't be doing it? Why wouldn't we get enough advantage out of it to make it cost-effective? KE2EJ, K2RAW.
Oh, you got me thinking. No, by the way, the guy's name that I put thinking before is Charlie Rhodes. Literally has written the measurements books on all of this, a lot of things like that.
Yeah.
Oh, it's funny because I'm thinking about it. I can almost picture it like being in the old days of TV. If you've got, let's say all the TV stations are like that, and you want to do DX things, no longer would you have like a black screen. You would get the random DMOD, which means nothing, so everything would be getting clocked through. And as you adjusted your antenna, you would actually see the stations kind of like fade in and fade out. But the thing is constantly thinking that there's signal there. An interesting experiment, to say the least.
There's a slight correlation here. That 3.579545 oscillator, chrominance demodulator signal on analog television had to be precise in frequency, had to be damn good in phase, otherwise Johnny Carson's face would turn green, so to speak, or Jay Leno's face would turn green.
Frequency was like plus or minus 10 cycles on a bit.
Hey, you're talking about jitter, but if you continuously slipped 10 cycles, then that picture would continuously slip through all of the chrominance, all the chrominance colors. 10 hertz of continuous frequency error for a full second would be thoroughly intolerable, I believe. Over to you, Eric, K2RAW.
FCC standard for color based plus minus 10 hertz. As far as like seeing the effect of the bus changing frequency over the period of a field, okay, if it's shifted over the period of a field, you would see phase shift in color. But if it's a slow moving thing, because the oscillator gets whacked every 64 microseconds. If it changes within the period of 64 microseconds, you don't see the effect because the phase lock loop that's running the demodulator shifts with it. Things about differential phase and differential gain in the transmitter, that's really all about frequency response. Because you're in essence really transmitting two little single sideband signals over the video.
10 hertz of error that you just discussed, Eric, when it comes to meeting FCC standards at the broadcast station, I can accept that. However, my local demodulator on each horizontal sync pulse kicks that back with the chrominance burst and hopefully relocks it. My locally generated oscillator must match your chrominance oscillator to the nearest couple of hertz during each frame, field, call it what you like. My local oscillator has to run lockstep with yours, even if both of us are 10 hertz high or 10 hertz low. We got to match each other. I'm guessing there's a similar characteristic with ATSC, that your clocks that you use and my clocks that I generate have to track each other, or I don't have coherent demodulation, is my belief. And both of those systems can be disciplined with modern-day GPS equipment, and that's not going to be a big cost-effective. If that was the Cadillac receiver that had all this an advantage of over-the-air broadcast reception, and it cost 50% more, I would pay it, and I'm not alone. KE2EJ, K2RIW.
K2RIW, K2EJ. You know, where I am, actually, I could actually do that. I could set that experiment up. The problem we have is digging into a receiver and feeding the clocks from a GPS discipline oscillator. The clocks in the receivers actually run at 13.5 and they run at double that. Don't forget, they run at 13.5, but that's not it's gonna run higher than that. The transport soon is kind of run, they run at 38, that's it. Okay. So you would have to phase off, use a divider from your 10 megahertz GPS and make your 38.2 or something, whatever the actual number is. And then from that, you could then drive the shift registers in the receiver, and away you go, but somebody's got to do that.
Eric, I'm going to bug you a little bit. Every 2 weeks I'm going to ask you, Eric, have you written that email to Spagnoli or anyone else who you think will listen, who's got some power, about synchronized oscillators between broadcast and reception to get the advantage of less vulnerability of over-the-air broadcast demodulation? And it's going to also, I guarantee it's also going to work for cable, because there's all kinds of glitches on cable. So that higher fidelity, greater periods of time where the television set doesn't say weak signal. Weak signal really means high bit error rate. It can't tolerate that particular environment. Every 2 weeks I'm going to ask you, have you written that email and what reply have you gotten? I'm going to bug you a little bit on this one, Eric, because I think there's something here of value. I give you a 50-50 chance. It is worth the tariff. KE2EJ, K2RIW.
Yeah, K2RIW, K2EJ. Actually, I happen to know the chairperson of the ATSC committee is working on ATSC 3.0. He's from PBS, but that's from the casting show. It's only a small group of people. Piece of it's not really too much. So. Yeah, I think I will do that. The whole subject is sort of very subjective. I mean, so they kind of designed it so the thing would go black when it had no signal. But they started doing that with analog TV. So there's there's probably some philosophies to be overcome in this, one being caught, another they don't like snow, things of that nature. All right, you can ask me in 2 weeks. You don't have an answer yet. KTORWK, do you care?
Yeah, I'm fairly sure this is required, Eric, because 3.0 is going to be more vulnerable to this phenomenon. I also predict that the way normal human nature works, that when you first advocate this, you're going to get pushback. They're going to say, not invented here, and it can't be a good idea. You're going to get pushback at first. Don't give up. I think there's a 50-50 chance there's a hell of an improvement here. And this going black, whether you do it with analog or digital, really is a kind of a squelch circuit. I don't like the fact that my picture becomes squelched. If you and I are trying to aim an antenna, you're standing on top of a building and you're, by some means you're able to see the picture and you're aiming the antenna, and if you get nothing at all because it's squelched, you get no information. If I get a snowy, yucky picture and I can aim the antenna back and forth and see the picture get better or worse, that's real data. You gotta give the guys the data. And so to cut off the data just to make the picture look pretty all the time, to claim that the picture is always beautiful or nothing, I don't like that. And it's a little bit too cutthroat from my point of view. Over to you, Eric, for any rebuttal on this. KEQEJ, KQIW, thank you for the info.
Oh, you're welcome, Dick. Oh, by the way, your modern TV set actually has an antenna strength meter on it. It's actually the lower part of it is actually real AGC signal strength, and when you finally get to the point where it can actually decode something, it becomes a bit error rate meter. But they do give you the ability to tune your antenna. And by the way, cable has absolutely no need for any of this stuff, because you don't have the problems with transmission. You don't even use the same standard. Actually, it's sort of a mini COFDM in the cable. By the way, if they do come up with a compatible ATSB, thank you, the combination ATSB COFDM system, which is being spoken of, actually was demonstrated at 98. Then, you retain your backwards compatibility, and then with the COFDM, you don't have anywhere near the reception problems that you have ATSB.
This is DPZ, Dick. I got one final question for you, Eric, but let's see what Hal wants to add to this. K6 DPZ, K2RIW. But you don't have the time to watch television these days, Hal.
If John could just give me a call on my cell phone in the car, I wanted to talk to him. That's the right question I had. If John's on there, if he can give me a call.
No phone at this location, Hal.
Later then, John, okay?
The final question I got for you, Eric, when you were describing earlier that all of these countries are real stacked close to each other, like states we've got in the United States, and back in the days of analog television, they all had their own individual standards as to where the chrominant signal was put, where the audio was put, separation between the two, and all that jazz. Was there some smart European television receiver manufacturer who made a general purpose receiver that you could tune to these various standards so that you could get any one of them if you wanted to? Was there somebody in Europe smart enough to sell such a thing like that? And was it super expensive? KE2EJ, KQLAW.
Oh, Europe, Sony was famous for doing that. Now, they generated a lot of business in the beginning. Other receiver manufacturers did that. Yeah, you could get it that way. A little more expensive, but...
And even though it's a little bit more expensive, from what you just said, they generated a lot of business. It's obvious people like you and me were curious enough, they wanted to see the other standard, they wanted to put up a high enough antenna and look at all the surrounding signals of all the surrounding countries, just like I've got a high enough antenna and I want to look at all the surrounding over-the-air television signals from all the surrounding states, and I do that. And so I can watch... I can watch television from Connecticut, Rhode Island, Southern New York State, New Jersey, Pennsylvania sometimes, Maryland and Delaware quite often, and so I get a kick out of that. So I think you're saying that somebody really was willing to pay for it, obviously. by the fact that Sony made quite a bit of profit on that thing. And I presume they were selling it for quite a period of time. Is that true, Eric? KEQEJ, KJRIW?
Yeah, Dick. The only thing is you needed to be a multilingual person, but you might be a very different language than yours. But yeah, just as much as if in the United States you could get multi-standard VCRs with by NTSC, PAL, PAL-M, NTSC 4.43, and CCAM. They were called World Receivers and World VCRs.
And although different than quite a few Americans, a significant number of Europeans speak multiple languages. You take Wes, for instance. I'll bet you he's down to his last three or four languages that he can understand to some degree, and I bet you he owned one of those receivers. N2XJN, K2RIW, go ahead, Wes.
It's a good question, because understanding is much easier than talking. Actually, say, all of the roots of the Slavic languages are alike. 20-something languages. Talking is a little different. There was a system, multi-system TV, SECAM, PAL SECAM. But there were also the Japanese systems as well. Pretty nicely sold in the end of 80s and 90s. And people were actually buying them from here and sending them to Europe because it was cheaper. And then finally, with the end of the communist regime, European countries decided to go to PAL system, which is different. And now you still have TVs if you want to have two systems, although the price of the television is so cheap right now, it simply doesn't pay for people to pay more for the two systems. The only country that reminds with this SECAM is Russia, so completely isolated.
Eric, you probably know this. I think France, or at least portions of France, is also on CCAM. Isn't that true? KE2EJ, K2RIW?
They started off with their version of CCAM, which is different than the Soviet version of CCAM. Different lines. Their line structure was 625. The Soviet was 819, is what I meant to get. But, They in the last 3 years or so, it was all PAL. Even the stuff that was being generated in CCAM was eventually transcoded into PAL and transmitted family. A frequency allocation from country to country is not the same.
If I understand you correctly, France was at one time using over-the-air broadcast their version of sequential CCAM. And I think you're saying they eventually switched over to PAL. As such, didn't that anger an awful lot of the citizens where the television set they used to have suddenly became obsolete and they were forced to buy another one and not reverse compatible? Didn't that create a lot of grief? Wouldn't you get rid of the president of the country under those conditions? KE2EJ, K2RIW?
Oh, they did what the British did when the British went for 4 or 5 years. They put up PAL transmitters, they didn't take the CCAM transmitters down until the last CCAM set was dead.
Okay, they did a slow changeover. And I guess to a certain degree we did that too. We had some analog channels and some digital channels for a while. And so, and that puts these pieces of paper worth some money, such that you could buy a demodulator for $40, even though it cost $80, because of the government giveaway on that. So we tried to ease the pain, and so it sort of worked. But still, we were promised we would have the same range, and that was not quite met. I mean, a hell of a lot of people in Southampton used to watch over-the-air analog television. Now, beyond Huntington, I don't think anybody, per se, more than a couple of percent of a couple of stragglers. Nobody's watching over-the-air digital television because they don't have the choice. So The range has almost been cut in half. Yeah, they're transmitting a smaller amount of power and they're saving an electricity bill. And they were promised the same range, but I don't think that promise has been realized, Eric. KE2EJ, KQRIW.
K2RIW, KE2EJ, well, you know, the range is, actually specified that it's superintendent. Actually, you crank the power up enough, so the range is very much an issue. If we had the synchronized clock, like we're talking about, you would be happily watching without your antenna being so damn high up. Up to your thing, although it might be hard to make out what the pictures actually are on that one. You know, given out in the Midwest and places where the terrain is flat, the range that they get is absolutely incredible. There's a lot of topography involved in it, along with it, a lot of other things. So if they go the CLFDM route, it's the next flavor of television. Talking about big power transmitters to try and make what we get now, but it will do it a lot better than what we have now. So, QRIW, can you do that?
Wait, are you telling me, Eric, that ATSC 3.0, when it comes about, quite possibly is going to have a significant amount of COFDM in there? And therefore, I think you've already told us the reverse compatibility probably will not be there. We'll have to buy a new converter box or a new TV. The good news is that TVs are becoming rather inexpensive these days. But still, I think reverse compatibility is going to be sacrificed in order to get, what is it now? Super density, what to call it? More than high density, but to get 3.0, we're going to be going more COFDM. Is that sort of the prediction, Eric? KE2EJ, KQRIW?
Yeah, well, the thing that seems to be exciting people is there seems to be a process where they're actually transmitting both simultaneously. They utilize the dead space of the HBSP, and they utilize the space inside the CLFDMs and the HBSP, where in essence it's supposed to be a backwards compatible system, but yet has the forward future system to look, you know, look ahead into the future where HBSP no longer exists. So, you know, another transitional kind of thing. But right now, I think there's like five or six choices, and they're still narrowing that down. Although I'm uneducated at the moment because I haven't read up on what's happened lately.
If you're transmitting both HVSB and COFDM on a timeshare basis, where you're flipping back and forth between the frames, fields, or whatever you're going to call it, you therefore are sacrificing power in each one of those modes, where if at later time you go over to full 100% COFDM, it's the equivalent of raising the transmitter power by 3 dB, so to speak. So you pay the price. You don't get something for nothing here. But still, I think you're saying that we're slowly reneging on what we thought was the advantage of 8VSB, and is Europe a little bit ahead of us that they chose COFDM, and we're starting to slowly sneak ourselves into that direction? Is that sort of what's going on here, Eric? KE2EJ, K2RIW?
Well, there's two different camps, okay? The push to COFDM is not so much technical as it is political. That push is coming from a company called Sinclair, which owns about a third of the TV stations, radio stations in the country. They're fans of CLFDM. They wanted CLFDM in the beginning when HBSB was selected. Then there's the HBSB and the enhanced HBSB camp, which is backwards compatible and is supposed to eliminate most of the issues that will come out. So, a group of guys are going to have to sit down and decide what's better. Oh, yeah, and then, of course, there's the camp that multiplexes the two of them together. Whereas that, in terms of power, what you're saying, because of time multiplexes and transit, there's periods where the HBSB signal is being produced without any useful data on it. And those spaces without the useful data in it can be the timing of the VOSM data. And it's in essence, you know, you're using the same, what am I trying to say? You're saying that there would be 3 dB more signal, and I'm saying that it would be exactly the same.
If I take current 8 VSB and now start looking at enhanced 8 VSB, what is the change that I have to make at the transmitter? What's the advantage I get at the receiver? Over to you, Eric, K2RIW.
Well, the way EBSD is now, the current version of it, that does the mobile and handheld, you essentially have to do several things. You're changing the exciter. The exciter knows about this additional information you can't get there. And you're also adding to your transport stream data that says that this is for a mobile receiver or a handheld receiver. The newer version of that is supposed to be a sequence in the data and a modification to the seller and a equalizer that goes with it. That's supposed to give you something like 60 dB better improvement in reception to your grade B area. Don't quote me on that, because I'm not absolutely certain. So, there's changes in the wind in terms of what already exists. So, you can see that there's competing factions that are looking forward to having their methodology be selected for
HES-3. The 6 dB improvement you just mentioned, Eric, is that a 6 dB improvement in the basic requirement for carrier-to-noise ratio to get 98%, 99% reception reliability? Is that what the 6 dB is? And this whole picture, as I see it, it's an evolving technology. This world is becoming more and more digital, obvious by WSJT, well, weak signal Joe Taylor, the K1JT techniques of where you can have a signal as weak as 28 dB below the noise, and you get 95% probability of receiving that message on the screen. I mean, these Reed Solomon and other techniques, these digital techniques have got some huge advantages, and so I think our television system is in a evolutionary stage where we think we have a standard, but the standard is a little bit spongy. It's slowly evolving. The good news is it's getting better. The bad news is that we're going to have to keep buying some new hardware as time goes on, and so the people who are not well off are going to suffer a little bit. But the big picture is that the picture we get on that screen is getting prettier and prettier. You look at a video recording, a kinescope recording, of what television looked like back in the days of Milton Berle. And we used to think that was fantastic. You look at that today and you say, my goodness, how do we tolerate such a fuzzy picture? KE2EJ, K2RIW.
No, I recommend you go into a PC Richards, a Best Buy, or a Sears, and have a look at an Ultra HD picture. By the way, they sold more of those things than they could ever possibly have hoped. There's a lot of limited stuff about it. I think it's only now Dish Network is putting on a UHD channel. Netflix runs UHD. So that means really you've got another little box for the hard drive and it can store the stuff there. By the way, it runs at about 23 megabits per second using HDTC. Quite phenomenal. But, you know, when ATSC was first born, what year was that? That was 1984 or 85 when the first concept came around. So, and then all of a sudden we had MPEG-4, and it's like, well, why did you choose MPEG-2?
If I go into PC Richards, and I have been there for at least 6 months, and I start looking at ultra-high-density television sets, you're telling me that I'm going to really be wowed. I'm going to be, I better not go in there with a checkbook or I'm going to lose something. How many of the programs broadcast
on over-the-air digital television today, will I be able to watch in the ultra-high-density mode? Are only some of the programs that way, or a significant percentage? I know that the leaders in this usually are CBS. So is CBS the leader in ultra-high-density television broadcast transmissions? Over you, Eric, K2LAW.
First, let me correct you. It's not ultra-high-density. It's ultra-high-definition. Over the air, there is none. Okay. On cable, they're just beginning to show up. Well, on satellite, it's just beginning to show up. And on some of the streaming services like Netflix and there are other things where, yes, you can see the movies in ultra-high-definition. I think there's also a couple of serial shows that are now shot in near HD. All the films, the motion picture films that you're seeing that are being shot, they're being shot in 4K, which is just slightly more than UHD. UHD is 3180, I forget it. It's in the 3000 line, the upper 3000 line range, and 4K, you know, 3800 or something. A few lines different than the UHD for the aspect ratio. I have to get those numbers right in my head. But when you look at it, I think you'll see an amazing difference.
So it's beginning to look like three-dimensional even before I wear the glasses. Wow. Okay, so I'm getting the impression that if I was a cable TV subscriber, and for a bunch of crazy traditional reasons I'm not, it's just a pride thing, it's dumb, but that's where I am. I'm the one house in all of Dix Hills that doesn't have cable TV. And they wonder what kind of a dinosaur I am. You guys know. Okay, so a significant number of the programs I would be getting on cable TV, via fiber, whatever, would be UHD. Is there a movement sometime in the future when UHD will be over-the-air broadcast, or is that out of the question, Eric? Do I have something to look forward to, or am I always going to be in the dark? KE2EJ, K2LAW.
Well, a couple of things. First of all, if you're getting a UHD channel off a cable, it's going to be a pay-per-view movie. But a lot of the broadcasters and the production companies are doing it. So now, as they replace their cameras, they're replacing their cameras with 4K cameras. The editing systems that we use, they're all capable of editing 4K or UHD. Actually, the program that I use on my laptop does UHD, and that's what I put in it from all the stuff that I shot in UHD. So the cinema and the TV, the cameras are becoming the same. So what the movie companies buy are well more sophisticated, costs lots and lots more money. Because it has more capabilities, more lens options, and so on. But the whole point of ATSC 3.0 is to be able to transmit UHD over the air.
Dick WS1, I'm showing 2,160 pixels he's looking for, according to the computer.
Beautiful number. Eric, I think you're one of the few guys I know who in his house has three-dimensional television, and I presume there's two or three different standards with different kinds of glasses. I presume almost all of that is cable or satellite. I presume almost no three-dimensional television exists as over-the-air digital broadcast. Is that true, Eric? KE2EJ, K2RIW. By the way, how popular is 3D reception?
It's who we are, baby.
When 3D was being pushed by the manufacturers, there was several 3D channels on the various satellite services on both stations, DirecTV and Cablevision and Comcast and a few others. It now dwindles down to just a few, and in some cases there may be one channel. So they've kind of left it to the 3D, to the, you know, the 3D Blu-ray market the main provider, although there are quite a number of 3D streaming services. The difference in glasses, by the way, moving away from the the liquid crystal shutter glass is moving more than the stuff that you have in the cinema, where it's just left hand, right hand circular polarization. It's laid out actually in the screen. There's two aligned polarizers in front of that. And of course, the pixels are placed in the right place for this point. And all the UHD sets all have that built into the current screen, so you could actually take the glasses home from the movie, put up something 3D on your UHD set, and it works just fine.
Wow. You ain't seen nothing yet. Okay, I've been hugging Eric for a long time. I know that we get a lot of response from people who just like hearing about the state-of-the-art of National Association of Broadcast and other broadcast in general, television. Anyone else here have any questions for Eric right now before we go over to the mailbag? Give me a call that is right now if you've got some further questions for Eric on broadcast or whatever. K2LIW listening.
Dick N2EO, I'd like to revisit PRB1 in a couple of weeks. Will you take a minute?
I'm not sure we're going to get to you tonight, Rich. I think that's going to have to wait. There seems to be no further questions. We're running very late now on our usual schedule. Let's go over to the mailbag. KC2WGB, K2LIW. Go ahead, John.
KC2WGB. Very good, Dick. Yeah, it's a little late tonight, but I do have one question I have to get in, and I know Paul has to come on here, too. So I want to cover this one question to settle a group that's trying to do some analysis work. They are looking at the 3 dB bandwidth question when measuring Q factors and things like that. They want to know where they can get more information, or maybe you could help them out and give them a quick description of what exactly that is used for, why do they use it, what do they gain, and what do they glean, what kind of information. Maybe give them a rundown on that, Dick, and that'll be it for the mailbag this week. KC2WGB, back to you, Dick.
Every useful RF circuit has a definable bandwidth. You could call it the half power bandwidth. In the case of an antenna, you can call it the frequency angle at which you get full half power. Every resonator that you put in a filter network, I mean your RF amplifier at the front end of your receiver has got some LC networks that are filtering the desirable signal and rejecting all the undesirable signal. Your oscillator has inductors and capacitors that are a resonator that determines the frequency the oscillator runs at. So every antenna has a lot of signals bouncing around. It really is a resonator. Every realistic antenna, every realistic tuning circuit is a resonator. So we're talking about resonance. Let me drop. Now, there are times when you want the bandwidth of that resonator to be very narrow because you're only listening to, let's say, a CW signal, and you want to reject everything else that's on adjacent frequencies. There are times when you want a tremendous bandwidth by comparison. In the case of a television reception, over-the-air broadcast television reception, each one of those channels is exactly 6 megahertz wide. You'd love to have a filter that across the top of that filter's bandpass, it's got a small fraction of a dB of ripple for 6 solid megacycles, and then on the right-hand side, it drops like a rock, and the left-hand side, it drops like a rock. We call that a brick wall filter. That's the most desirable filter you could have for the front end of your television receiver. And when you tune to channel 33, you want that filter to be centered on the channel 33 frequency, which may be somewhere around 500 megahertz, and 6 plus or minus 3 megacycles from that center, you want that signal to come through with no amplitude variation, no phase variation, and then all the adjacent frequencies you want to drop off. So measuring bandwidth of filters, there are times you want them to be very broad. In the case of radio astronomy, you might be building an RF front end of a radio telescope that is 6 gigahertz wide, and I'm not kidding. There are times when you're building a filter for a phase lock loop where you want it to be 6 hertz wide, and I'm not kidding. The difference between 6 hertz and 6 gigahertz is a billion to one. That's how loud a difference in bandwidth. So bandwidth is defined in various ways. You have a sweeping oscillator. Let me drop. So you could have a swept oscillator signal generator that sweeps from
let me pick a number, 100 megs to 200 megs, and somewhere in the middle of that region, you've got a filter that's trying to favor 144 to 148 megahertz, the 2 meter amateur band. And so the signal generator hopefully is flat, well regulated. It's got a phase lock loop. It's got a it's got an amplitude a corrector circuit so that it's putting out a constant amount of power, we'll say minus 10 dBm across the frequency region. You apply that to the filter with the right kind of attenuators to make sure that there's no bouncing signal back and forth to the signal generator. So you've got the right kind of attenuators, and you've got a detector at the output. And on an oscilloscope, you display that bandpass. That's very valuable information. Okay. Once you know the bandwidth of a filter, you have a reasonably good definition of its rise time. If my swept frequency measurement happened to be 1 megahertz wide, you take 1 megahertz, divide it into 0.3, I think is the number, and that tells you the amount of time for rise time. So my 1 megacycle happens to be 1 microsecond per cycle, so therefore a 1 megacycle wide filter, if it was one single Gaussian pole filter, would have a rise time in the vicinity of 0.3 microsecond. You put a very brief rising pulse. You have a signal generator now that can make a very fast rise time of its, let me pick a number, 144 megacycle signal. So a 144 megacycle signal is turned on very sharply by the signal generator. It's applied to my 1 megacycle wide filter. On the output of that filter, I've got a crystal detector into a fast oscilloscope, and I will measure
repeater timeout.
And I will measure in that example a 1 megacycle wide filter. I will measure 0.3 microsecond of rise time, where in this case, rise time is 10% to 90%. In other words, I'm looking at that trace on the oscilloscope for the rise in the video output voltage coming from that crystal detector that's detecting what signal gets flowed through that filter. I first apply that crystal detector directly to the signal generator, and if my signal generator has real high quality to it, the rise time at the signal generator might be close to 1 nanosecond. But I take that very brief rising pulse, apply it to my filter. Because of the bandwidth of the filter and the laws of physics, what comes out of the filter is now a 0.3 microsecond, 300 nanosecond rise time in rough rule of thumb. What's going on here? Let me drop. And in order to see a physical example of what's happening, it's a little bit like pushing your child on a swing. A child swinging back and forth on an ordinary swing with a good set of bearings at the top of the swing is an extremely high Q circuit. By that I mean you take your index finger and you push the belt of your child with 1 ounce of force, but you do it the exact correct timing. You're pushing her with 1 ounce of force on each individual swing, and after a certain period of time, after a certain number of swings, and maybe it's 50 swings, she has now built up to an extremely high deflection, slowly increasing. That's a high Q circuit. You're measuring its rise time with that particular signal generator, which happens to be your index finger pushing against your child's belt, so to speak. And you notice that the child does not get full amplitude of swing instantaneously. It's a slow buildup where you can define the Q of that circuit, the bandwidth of that circuit. And if you did it a little bit, let me drop. If you did it a little bit out of phase, you're pushing with your index finger is a little bit too early or a little bit too late, you will not build up the same amplitude at the same rate. And if you do it twice the frequency that's required, nothing will happen at all. If she's supposed to swing back and forth once every 3 seconds, and you push her once every 6 seconds, or you push her every 1.5 seconds, you'll build up no deflection at all, per se. That's the magic of resonance. So all circuits have a rise time, depending on the strength of the signal generator and the coupling. Yeah, you could use a lot more force on the child, and therefore build up a larger amplitude sooner. That's the equivalent of using a stronger signal generator with a greater bandwidth of filter, so to speak. So every filter has a rise time and fall time. the mathematics of that. We call that Q, okay? Q is one of the definitions of filter resonance phenomena. It has five definitions that are really one definition. Let me explain that one. In the case of a resonator, where you've got a light coupling into it, in other words, I've got an inductor and a capacitor side by side, connected in parallel, and the inductor consists of five turns of a wire-wound inductor on a plastic rod, we'll say. And one turn up from the bottom, I couple my input signal generator. In that particular network, I've now got a defined input coupling impedance, and I can put another tap on that wire somewhere else, or I can make the capacitor a split capacitor, and it's a capacitor divider network, and I can use that as the output. There's various ways I can couple energy into and out of a resonator. Depending on how far up from ground I couple is going to be a function of my input loading and my output loading. You can take a resonator that all by itself has an extremely high Q, that means very narrow bandwidth, and I'll explain that one in a minute, and I can convert it to a very broad bandwidth, not by changing the inductor and the capacitor, just by changing the input loading and the output loading. As my signal generator is coupled into a greater number of turns on the input, I've now more heavily loaded that inductor. In other words, the inductor is now more heavily influenced by the impedance of that signal generator. And I can do the same thing with the load. So when it comes to measuring the insertion loss of a filter network, there's a formula you can plug into, let me drop, where you take the Q unloaded, the natural resonance of the natural bandwidth of the filter before you add the input coupling network and the output coupling network. By way of a grid dip meter and various other techniques, you can measure the unloaded Q of your resonator. Then you put in your loading circuit, which is the input coupling and the output coupling circuit, and now you have a brand new broader bandwidth, and the ratio between the Q loaded and the Q unloaded, plugged into a formula, tells you the exact insertion loss of that filter. As the ratio gets bigger and bigger between Q loaded and Q unloaded, the insertion loss gets lower and lower, that's the good news, but the filter characteristics get sloppier and sloppier. The filter becomes wider and wider. So that's the compromise, that's the trade-off. As an engineering designer of filter networks, you're going to be choosing the best inductor you can get your hands on without spending a lot of money and taking up a lot of volume. Let me drop. You're going to choose the best capacitor you can afford that has the smallest amount of internal equivalent series resistance. Therefore, that inductor and that capacitor put together represent a very high unloaded Q structure. And if you can make the unloaded Q high enough, then when you add the loading network, the perturbation is going to be relatively small, and you'll get a great big ratio between the two and still have sufficient filtering left when you add the loading of the input network and the output network. Therefore, you'll have a relatively small insertion loss and relatively good filtering. As I said, Q is one of the things that's used for measuring what's called the quality factor of a resonator. Q has what appears to be five definitions. Let me drop. One is the center frequency divided by bandwidth. If my filter had a center frequency of 100 megahertz, and if it had a bandwidth of 1 megahertz, and if I divide the 1 into 100, the answer is that circuit has a Q of 100. Center frequency divided by bandwidth is one of the definitions of Q. Another definition of Q is voltage rise at resonance. I've coupled into one turn of that five-turn inductor, and I put 1 volt on it, but across that whole inductor, there might be 10 volts. Voltage rise at resonance, because I'll get 10 volts across the whole resonator, but I'm only injecting 1 volt into that one turn, that 10-to-1 ratio, in that example tells me I've got a Q of 10, voltage rise at resonance. I could also measure the current that's flowing through the inductor-capacitor combination. Because they're resonating, there's a certain amount of current flowing between the two. I might put in 100 milliamps of signal, AC signal, and yet the current flowing between the inductor and the capacitor is 1 ampere. 0.1 ampere is 100 milliamps. I'm putting in 100 milliamps, but after it comes up to full speed, full amplitude, it's very similar to the child coming up to full swing on the swing, I measure 10 amperes and I'm only putting in 1 ampere, or I'm measuring 10 volts and I'm only putting in 1 volt. In those two examples, I've got a Q of 10. Voltage rise at resonance, current rise at resonance. That's another definition of Q. Energy stored per cycle versus energy dissipated per cycle. In other words, I know that there's a 10-volt signal flowing across an inductor in a capacitor. At the peak of the voltage, 10 volts, I know the amount of voltage across that capacitor, exactly 10 volts. I know the capacitance in farads. I plug in the formula 1/2 CV squared, and now I calculate the number of joules of energy stored in that capacitor. So I know that at the
repeater, timeout.
I know that at the peak, we dropped for a little longer. I know that the peak of voltage on that inductor capacitor network, I have a certain amount of voltage across a known number of microfarads or farads of capacitor. I plug into that formula, I know the number of joules that are stored. That's energy stored per cycle. But I know how many volts I'm applying, I know how many volts are coming back out, I know the number of watts coming out of the circuit. Energy stored per cycle in joules versus energy coming out per cycle, joules per cycle, so to speak, joules per second, if you like, or joules per microsecond. So that ratio is also Q. Rise time, as I gave you before, 0.3 divided by the bandwidth is the usual rough definition for the Q of a circuit. And I can also measure the fall time. In other words, I've been running the circuit continuously. It's got 10 volts on it. I instantaneously turn off the signal generator and watch the signal decay. It's like a ringing a bell, and I'm now measuring the amplitude of the bell versus time. So look at those five or six definitions. Energy stored per cycle versus energy dissipated per cycle. Center frequency divided by bandwidth. Voltage rise at resonance. Current rise at resonance. Rise time and fall time. It sounds like five or six definitions of Q. They are five or six different ways of looking at the exact same phenomena, the exact same circuit. Let me drop. You think you've got five definitions for Q. You've got five different ways of measuring it, but they are all the exact same phenomena. You've got a resonator. You're putting energy into this resonator, whether you call it a flywheel, whether you call it a swing, whether you call it an LC network, whether you call it a quartz crystal, which is a mechanical resonance. These are all resonators. And the highest Q resonator you're likely to ever see is a quartz crystal carefully mounted in a vacuum environment inside of a crystal holder. There are quartz crystals that approach a Q of 1,000,000. That means a 1 megacycle quartz resonator can, in theory, have a bandwidth of 1 hertz of bandwidth. And there are circuits you can build where the bandwidth is not in hertz, but it's in millihertz and microhertz, even though it sounds crazy. So this gives you a little bit of a feeling for what is bandwidth, what is Q, what is a filter, why do we do it? Let me drop. The bottom line of all this is, as an electrical engineering circuit designer with RF circuits, you're going to spend the rest of your life living with resonators. Inductors and capacitors put together in various combinations to make pi filters, L networks, crystal resonator networks, lattice networks, all kinds of things that select desirable frequencies and reject undesirable frequencies, and do it in the time domain, the amplitude domain, the frequency domain, the phase domain, and so on. As you put various frequencies across a filter, you get various amounts of response, both in amplitude and phase shift, the rate of phase shift across the filter versus frequency. It's called dispersion. It's also called group delay and distortion. So all of these things are related to Q and methods of measuring bandwidth and resonance. I didn't say this is simple. There are people who spend a good fraction of a lifetime coming up with zillions of techniques for synthesizing filters with finite elements. Let me explain that one. There are a whole bunch of equations and algorithms you can follow in order to design an ideal pi network, an ideal T network, an ideal lattice network, an ideal filter arrangement, an ideal duplexing filter, diplexing filter. I mean, that filter that you use on every repeater has four or six extremely high Q cavities.